Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Your son, Don Jr., is up before the Senate Intelligence Committee today. And again, he was not charged with anything. In retrospect, though,
by the way, not only wasn't he charged, if you read it, with all of the horrible fake news, I mean, I was reading that my son was going to go to jail. This is a good young man, that he was going to go to jail. And then the report comes out, and they didn't even say, they hardly even talked about it.
Should he have gone to the FBI when he got that email?
Okay, let's put yourself in a position. You're a congressman. Somebody comes up and says, hey, I have information on your opponent. Do you call the FBI?
I'll tell you what,
I've seen a lot of things over my life. I don't think in my whole life I've ever called the FBI. In my whole life. You don't call the FBI. You throw somebody out of your office. You do whatever
you want. Al Gore got a stolen briefing book. He called the FBI.
Well, that's different, a stolen briefing book. This isn't a stolen. This is somebody that said, we have information on your opponent. Oh, let me call the FBI. Give me a break. Life doesn't work that way.
The FBI director says that's what should happen.
The FBI director is wrong.
Your campaign this time around, if foreigners, if Russia, if China, if someone else offers you information on an opponent, should they accept it or should they call the FBI?
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it. If I thought there was something wrong, I'd go maybe to the FBI if I thought there was something wrong. But when somebody comes up with OPPO research, right, they come up with OPPO research. Oh, let's call the FBI. The FBI doesn't have enough agents to take care of it. But you go and talk honestly to congressmen. They all do it. They always have. And that's the way it is. It's called OPPO research.
This is after they gave Stephanopoulos 2 days of, it seems like, almost unfettered access to the president. Oh my! I guess I'm hearing that this was the president's own decision to allow the fox into the hen house. But the approach of Stephanopoulos, I think, is to kind of hang out with the president, then kind of sidle up to him and say, well, what are they going to give you this?
Yeah, there are other clips where they're both, like, crunched in the limousine together. It's all very
strange. Why would you agree to this? Like, on what planet would this be a good idea? I don't understand this at all. But nevertheless, the Democrats are going bananas today. They feel like, now the Mueller investigation, although closed, its proponents are breathing a new life into the underlying charges that the Democrats keep leveling at the president, saying, look, he's in plain sight, saying he's going to be open to colluding with foreign powers and using information they give him to win the next election cycle. So this is all the left needed to kind of reinvigorate their calls for impeachment.
I think the president's answer to George Stephanopoulos yesterday underscores the importance of moving forward with impeachment. Not only does that ensure that we get the facts and to the truth about what happened to our democracy in 2016 and hold those who are responsible for undermining our elections accountable, but if we fail to do that, it then sets the precedent that this is okay to do.
Okay, I'm just going to call him 3% from now on. What is he at, 3%?
2%.
2%. I'm going to call him 2%. So Beto's not going to be called Beto. We have our own nickname, 2%. So 2% is saying that this is just, now we have to just move to impeachment. Well, heaven forbid they actually argue the substance of Donald Trump's policies or where the country is economically. They can't do that, so they have to go to impeachment. This is all they have. Joining us now, the author of the new fantastic book, Unmasked, Big Media's War Against Trump, Brent Bozell and Tim Graham's new book, and of course exposing how the media are working hand in glove with the DNC and people like Soros and others in the globalist philanthropy set to try to remake America, refound America under what I would say are foreign principles. You want to talk about foreign interference? How about foreign understanding of the way to do business in the country or the way to be citizens of this country? They want to completely redo it. And they're getting a lot of help from their friends in the media the dominant media culture. Brent joins us now. The new book, Unmasked, is on our Facebook page and also lauraingram.com. Brent, congrats on the book, my friend.
Thank you, Laura. It was a lot of fun writing it. But, you know, it's kind of timely right now, given the topic at hand. A couple of observations on that. I thought, first and foremost, what the president said could not have made more sense. It is the head-scratcher that has been there since the very beginning for me. What in the world was the problem all along? It is Oppo research. You have to ask yourself, how many meetings did the Clinton campaign have with people who said they had dirt on Donald Trump? You don't order an FBI investigation into the person who makes the phone call to you. You hear the person out. If you suspect something, then you contact the authorities. It's just as simple as that. God only knows how many times it was done with the Clinton campaign, and it's all perfectly acceptable. So what he said was true. Now, to your bigger point about Stephanopoulos, whoever made that decision must come forward and say, I simply do not understand the world of communications and the world of politics today. George Stephanopoulos, in our book Unmasked, we list the 10 worst reporters. George Stephanopoulos came in at number 3.
Right, I saw it.
That's Trump. Here he is, a guy who was covering, who never recused himself in the 2016 campaign, though he was a $75,000 donor to Clinton's foundation. Never saw a conflict of interest in there. Here's a guy who hasn't given a minute, a second's worth of coverage, interview coverage, to Mark Levin and 5 number one bestsellers. Has he ever interviewed you for any of your bestsellers? And yet he gives James Comey, with his book, an entire hour, which you and I both know is unprecedented to do that. So what in the world is this White House doing giving this guy this access?
Well,
you know, it's only bad news.
Yeah, I poked around a little bit on that question, and I mean, what if the president made the decision? What if
terrible decision.
And I don't know that for a fact, but if he made that decision, it was a really, I mean, I'm you know, everyone knows I've been his friend for 20 years, so I can, you know, friends friends tell other friends. Well, I've made plenty of mistakes in my life. My friends have had to correct me many times, but this was just not a good decision. Okay, you can't sit around and like have him walk around. Just the visuals of having Stephanopoulos walk around the back of the Oval Office desk, and I didn't like that at all. Reagan would never have allowed that.
Republicans do this all the time. They're snake bit in that they either believe people who are giving them a pile of hooey by acting. You know, Laura, you know, you've not been around for years. We understand the game. These media reporters call you and they're your best friends. They tell you, oh, what a wonderful job we're going to do. The story then comes out and their response is, well, we changed our mind. We decided to go, quote unquote, in a different direction. It happens all the time. And yet, you see so many Republicans and conservatives, too, open themselves up to these problems by consenting to these interviews. Maybe the president thought he's just more persuasive than George Stephanopoulos. Maybe he thought, well, I can use him. Because in this war on the media, he's been winning. So maybe he thought that, but then I would say, Mr. President, that was too cute by half, because it just didn't serve his purposes.
No, unfortunately, and it just it keeps the ghost of Mueller alive and moves us into a conversation, or the media into a conversation, an easy conversation, away from all the Trump successes, which are myriad, and back to this absurd idea that Trump is just waiting for foreign information to run his campaign in a more effective way. I mean, it's just that is patently ridiculous. If you were going to do that, why you wouldn't come out publicly and say, "Yes, I'm wanting to have a foreign government interfere in the election." I mean, you wouldn't do that.
You know, Laura, we know that all manner of bad guys are trying to cause trouble with the democratic system in this country, whether it's China, whether it's North Korea, whether it is Russia, whether it's playing with Facebook, whether it's doing other kinds of hanky-panky. One thing I can absolutely guarantee you they're all trying to do is influence candidates. What's the best way to do that? Start spreading rumors. And how do you do that? You call a candidate and you say, I've got something on you, and you don't disclose who you are. This is just not hard to figure out. And I'm sure they've been trying to do it. They're trying to do it right now with all the Democrats. That's what they do. They wreak havoc on the system. They're trying to do it with everyone. So I think the president was being absolutely honest about this and straightforward and telling it like it is and conceding nothing wrong at the same time. But you're right. Why do it? Why do it?
It's crazy. We're talking to Brent Bozell, whose new book, Unmasked, is must reading for anyone who cares about real information, real news, real analysis that will actually help people of all backgrounds and political persuasions to make better decisions and to be informed. And by the way, Brent and Tim rank Jim Acosta as the number one member of the media who hates Trump. And Acosta himself, he's out hawking some book that nobody's buying. And this is what he said.
What I found out on the campaign trail covering this president over at the White House is that some of his supporters are absorbing that hostility and then directing it at us in ways that I think are making some of us feel endangered. And the question becomes whether or not a reporter in this country is hurt or, God forbid, killed as a result of this escalating rhetoric. And at that point, Wolf, we cross over into a new category of a country. We join other countries around the world where the press is not safe to do their jobs. And I just don't think we should be going down that path.
So he's essentially saying his life is in danger because of all the anti-press rhetoric, I imagine, from the likes of you and me.
Which is a shorthand of way of saying, buy my book, please buy my book, buy right. my book. Let me ask you this, though. Do you remember Bernie Shaw, the anchor?
Yeah,
of
course, from CNN.
Can you tell me what his politics were?
No.
No. Why? Because Bernie Shaw would be furious if he knew what his politics were, because Bernie Shaw did everything in his power not to show them, because it wasn't about him. The reason Jim Acosta got our number one is he could care less about what the story is. He wants to be the story. You just heard it in that clip. How many times did he say, me and us? It's all about him. It's not about covering the news. But this is a man who's a shameless self-promoter, not to mention a rude self-promoter in the way that he's been behaving, grabbing microphones out of people's hands, being as rude as he could possibly be in front of the president
of
the United States. I don't care what you think of the president. You simply do not do that. But this guy's a self-promoter. CNN is loving it. They are in the toilet in ratings. I just saw their new numbers. 529,000 people at night, their primetime audience. That's less than 0.2% of the American people. That's all they got left. And then we did some comparisons. Do you know that there are more people who own pet chickens than watch CNN? Yeah. Do you know that there are more prostitutes in America than viewers of CNN?
But you know what's amazing to me, among other things, is that the guy who headed up CNN, Jeff Zucker, just gets promoted. You know, Andy Lack, you know, comes back for another bite of the apple at NBC. All these people seem to get promoted even though they fail. And you know, the old laws of, well, if you don't get your job done, you're going to lose your job, those seem to be out.
Jimmy Kellner used to be the head of a network out in Hollywood, and a liberal Democrat, but a good guy. We used to talk about things out there, and he would always insist, it's about the numbers, nothing else. No ideology, nothing else, it's just the numbers. So he was given the presidency of CNN. I called him, and I congratulated him, and I said, now I'm going to do you two favors, and you'll owe me forever. And he said, well, what are they? And I said, number one, I'm going to show you how to become the number one network on television. Number one, you fire up CNN One, get on that jet, head south to Palm Beach, try to find the directions to Rush Limbaugh's house, bring a checkbook, knock on the door. When he opens the door, sign the check, hand it to him, tell him, Mr. Limbaugh, you can fill it in for whatever amount you want, and you can do anything you want to in this network. And in 1 week, Jamie, you'll have the number one network on television. He listened to me and he said, so what's your second idea?
Yeah,
whatever you do, don't pick a fight with Roger Ailes. this guy eats chews roofing nails for breakfast, and don't pick a fight. 2 weeks later, I read an article in the paper, and it quotes Jamie Kellner as saying, "We're going to be a real news network, not like Fox News." 2 weeks after that, I was with Roger in New York. We were going up to his office. We got off the elevator, and big sign on the other side of the elevator, "We're going to be a real network, not like Fox News." I said, "Roger, why is that there?" And he said, "Just to piss me off." And he took out Jamie Kellner within a month. This is the attitude of CNN. They'd rather go down in flames than do what's necessary to bring in an audience, to have any semblance of
Yeah, well, they do that on, Brent, they do that on a whole host of ways. I mean, look at what they did with Roseanne. They had a huge following on that show. They got rid of her, and then they started another show. It didn't work. But imagine if they actually decided they were going to appeal to all of America instead of just a metropolitan audience.
And look what happened about 3 weeks ago, where a whole litany of conservatives came forward, Jeffrey Lord and Ken Cuccinelli and others, all of whom said they had been hired as conservative voices there, and the moment they defended the president, they were all fired.
Yeah, we'll talk about. I mean, this is kind of the Pravda of the left. I mean, there's no audience. So my question to you is, Brent, for people out there who are concerned about how conservative voices, other than primetime at Fox, and your work with Media Research Center and your appearances and things you've done with Parents Telephone Council, that's all great. But other than the few conservative voices that are out there, there isn't a lot, really, for conservatives as far as the spoken word video medium to look to, right? And a lot of them are being thrown off YouTube or thrown off Facebook. So what do conservatives do next?
Well, ironically, when we started 30 years ago, there were less voices for conservatives than there are today. There was a complete monopoly on information that was coming out. If you wanted to get your message out, you went to National Review that published a magazine every 2 weeks. You went to Human Events that had a tiny audience, or what the heck, you just rolled up a message in a bottle and threw it in the ocean. You just, mm-hmm. conservatives couldn't communicate their ideas. But what you had now was this opening. First talk radio, then the internet, then social media, all these things offered opportunities for conservatives. What conservatives have to understand is that their number one enemy is not Nancy Pelosi, it's not any one of the 48,000 Democrats who are running for president, it's the national news media that are setting the agenda in America today. The national news media, in turn, recognize that the only way they can gain absolute power is to control the world of information absolutely, which is why this censorship campaign is underway, especially on social media that reaches billions of people worldwide. This is frightening, frightening stuff. Conservatives have to understand that we're going rapidly from the news era to the information age, and we have to look for our information from credible sources and get away and recognize all these leftist organizations across the spectrum that are trying to influence the American people.
No, well, Brent, I don't know what we would do without you. I mean, your book is awesome. It is a compendium, a resource, a read that is absolutely necessary today going into the 2020 election cycle. Know who's on this naughty list and understand that when you see their video clips come up, you see them on television, they're coming from a political agenda that is contrary to what many of you believe and want advanced in this country. And they're trying to undermine this president. The book is Unmasked, Big Media's War Against Trump. Brent Bozell and Tim Graham. Brent, thank you so much for what you do every day. We really appreciate you.
Laura, likewise. Thank you.
All right. We'll take a quick break here on the Laura Ingraham podcast to remind you that if you are feeling a little bit kind of, sometimes during the day, you suddenly feel a wave of tiredness. Has that ever happened to you? Well, you might be experiencing a loss of energy or some trouble sleeping. and you feel like your skin doesn't look the way it used to look. And a major cause of these this feeling is a decline in human growth hormone, or HGH. Well, I have some good news for you, because Cerovital is clinically shown to increase your body's natural production of HGH to levels that are closer to what you experienced in your 20s and 30s. And it's the newest scientific breakthrough, and Cerovital Advance delivers all of the benefits of the original formula, plus now you get accelerated skin improvements, and it'll help your weight loss efforts, I'm telling you. And people are reporting this as little as 15 days later. Incredible. Not only that, the users experience more energy. Their mood is better. Who doesn't need that? Better sleep, reduced cravings. All this and no added hormones or harmful chemicals, people. So listeners to the Laura Ingraham podcast can get 20% off their Cerovital order. Just go to Cerovital.com. That's Cerovital.com. And then use the promo code Laura. So 20% off your purchase at Cerovital.com. Use the promo code Laura. Order today and you'll even get free shipping. Again, Cerovital.com. Promo code L-A-U-R-A.
Need a little boost to your self-esteem? Then check out Creating Confidence with Heather Monahan on Podcast One.
I'm so grateful to have you here with me.
Join the upbeat entrepreneur as she helps you figure out the keys to success, from crushing it like Gary Vee to finding self-fulfillment with comedian-turned-life coach Lisa Lampanelli.
And I get out of the car and go, if they see me walking into the tanning place with no makeup on, a house coat and slippers, they're going to be like, she really has fallen. And worse, she has a freaking Nissan Sentra.
Download new episodes of Creating Confidence with Heather Monahan every week on Apple Podcasts or Podcast One.
Podcast One Sportsnet is your home for the best NBA Finals postgame coverage as the Toronto Raptors duke it out with the Golden State Warriors.
Kawhi, listen, I'm not going to give a guy a cookie when he's supposed to do something because you're supposed to do it. You're a superstar. Play like that.
With Dan Patrick, Rich Eisen, The Big Podcast with Shaq, Real GM, and so many more, only on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.
When I think about how I would actually spend a year without my smartphone, it would include things like making sure I actually got to the gym every day, walking the dog instead of sitting on my phone uploading to Facebook and Instagram. It would be actually attending those parent-teacher conferences. And because I work from home, I would definitely take more time to read.
Well, you don't end up doing what you need to do for your family, yourself, growing your brain, knowing more about the world around you when you're stuck online. Or you feel like you have to be online, always have to be tethered to your phone. What does that do for kids? What does that do for parents? Joining us now is Dr. Lisa Stroman. She's a clinical psychologist, attorney, and founder of Digital Citizen Academy. It's an online curriculum dedicated to improving the lives of students, parents, and educators. And it uses great resources, tools, and knowledge to help foster a healthy balance with technology. She joins us now. Dr. Stroman, it's so important that we have this conversation, I think, before the beginning of the next school year, during the summertime, because there are so many moms that I know who during the summer is like, oh, I don't want to spend all this money on camps. I have to work during the day. So what if I let my kid, you know, have a few hours online? What's the big deal? What do you say to those parents who are just kind of throwing their hands up? They're just frustrated and they, you know, let their kids become free range kids on the internet.
Well, first of all, I absolutely empathize with them because I am one of those mothers. So I'm
me
in
too.
This with everyone.
Me too.
Yeah, I mean, it is really hard, but you look at the numbers and you have on average these kids that are old enough to stay home now are online between 7 and 11 hours a day. And we know scientifically it impacts the brain. It actually reduces their cortical thickness. It causes their brains to stop working as efficiently as it should at this very critical developmental point. So, you know, again, like I can't speak highly enough about how do we educate not just us as parents because it's complicated, but how do we get the information to our kids? because they will make better choices once they know. And that's what's so important and what I've kind of dedicated all of my time to doing.
Well, when children know that they have a limited period of time on the internet and they have to earn that, does that make it better, assuming there are guardrails in place and bad sites are filtered out? Is kind of treating it as a reward for other things a better way to go?
I think it's absolutely a better way to go. And I think that as a parent, you're doing a big benefit to your kids if you at least understand that there should be some limits, that we can reward certain things. And when I talk to parents and go and speak on this issue, I talk about it as being like a digital pyramid, like a food pyramid, right? There's stuff on the top you really don't want your kids to consume, and there's stuff on the bottom that it's okay if they're consuming. And the difference really with the families that I see are so successful is they understand what is the junk food of digital consumption and what is the stuff that's more healthy and more appropriate for our kids to have.
And Dr. Stroman, the amount of time that young people spend on their phones is shocking. We referenced some of this before, but 85% of smartphone users will check their device while speaking with friends and family. Now, the other night we were out at a restaurant, my kids, just a local little kind of divey place near us. And my kids now, see, none of them have phones. They're 9, 11, and 14, and I'm just not getting them phones. I mean, I'm like the hated parent, but I don't care. They're not getting. My daughter's like, when am I getting a phone? I said, how does never sound to you? You're not getting one, ever. And so I'm like, I'm such a dinosaur, but
it
I don't care.
Perfect.
I just don't care. I literally don't care. So if you have, if she has to call me, everyone around her can, you know, she can borrow a phone. So I'm not worried about that. At least not until she's kind of at the end of high school. She already has, you know, some attention issues, and so the last thing I want to do is give her a phone. It's too tempting. But when you see that lack of human interaction because a screen is now in between you and your child, or a husband and wife, or a boyfriend even, and a girlfriend. I've seen this on first dates because I've asked the people. I'm like, just a question. Are you guys on a first date? Yes. And I was like laughing, like, how many times did you just check your phone, dude? Like, at my age, you can do that. You're just like an annoying old lady. And the guy's like, well, just a few times. I said, that's not romance. I don't know what that is. That's not romance. Oh, my gosh. Like, I start – and then usually the other person on the other side of it will start laughing like, yeah, this doesn't make any sense. Yet they get sucked into that pattern. So, Dr. Stroman, let's just focus for the moment. We're going to talk about the dangers of what this does to your attention and your overall well-being. But the practical way we interact with each other just at a meal – give us your 1, 2, 3 on that.
The minute you pull out a cell phone, to your point, you're going to really lose that emotional connection. You're not listening to the other person. Most people don't realize the minute you have a cell phone out, you lose 40% of the attention of what that person is saying with you. So if you have a cell phone out during a meal, you basically are telling the other person you're important enough unless something more important comes up. And it's just disrespectful, and it's rude, and it's really one of the pieces that I see that breaks down an American family connection, whether it's a relationship or with your kids. It really is something that we should, as people with cell phones, understand we have to be thoughtful to the people we're sitting with.
Well, I can't tell you how many times even now my kids notice this. Because, I mean, I bring it up. Like, you're not really talking. I mean, I always say, eyes. Look at me. Eyes. Eyes. Your eyes tell the whole story. And if you're looking down, you're telling the other person, I don't really care about you because there's something on eBay or something on Instagram that's more interesting than this conversation.
Well, and I would have to give you credit for being a thoughtful parent. I would say when I look out and have these conversations and traveling across the U.S., I would say 80% of parents don't stop to have that conversation to note those kids or people, even adults, that aren't connecting to one another, that have their cell phones out all of the time. You're a busy woman. I'm a busy person. If I'm with my kids, my cell phone is gone. That is their time because it is so precious. And I think that we just have been sold this bill of goods that we have to be connected all the time. And that's where I feel like we lose each other and we lose that empathy and compassion for one another.
No, I can't agree more. Dr. Stroman, tell us specifically about the dangers of screen addiction or screen obsession, especially to the developing brain. And then we're actually going to move into what it does for adults and their daily lives. So let's start first about the youngest of children. I see kids who are barely able to walk already on iPads, sitting in strollers, which is just shocking to me. At sports things, and I was at a thing with my son, a flag football game a couple weeks ago, and it was like the blazing sun. The kid was in a stroller with one of those little covers over the stroller. So he wasn't in the direct sunlight, but he was sitting outside, and the father just plopped the iPad right in front of him. He must have been maybe 3 years old, maybe.
It's devastating. I mean, literally, when you look at these young children, there's only two times in our life that our brain actually has a growth of brain matter, and it is at the toddler years, which is between 2 and 3, which is why they become super chaotic and difficult. And that's typically when, in the U.S. at least, we're handing them their first kind of usable device. And the minute that you hand that to them, the developmental structures in the brain start to wire differently. They're not playing catch. They're not making eye contact. They're not walking as much. So all of those developmental structures and connections that should be made tend to wire in a different way when you're handing them those devices really early. The second time that they get that brain development and the last time in our lifetime is at puberty. And so if you can imagine, like, there's the two worst times that we could hand a device to someone whereby we know that they're going to actually wire their brains differently and lose an ability to have these impressive neuronal connections is at puberty and at toddler years. And those are the two times in the U.S. that we typically push forward and give them greater access. So it literally will hobble them. And I just can't say that the industry itself doesn't recognize that because of those developmental periods in time, that it's much easier for the kids to get hooked at those times because their brain is seeking out unique neural connections. And so, you know, again, conspiracy or not, you just have to look at kind of the trends of when it's coming out. And when you, as a parent, are educated and you educate the kids, which is what DCA is all about, they start to make better choices. Right, they start to understand, like, hey, maybe I shouldn't be using this for hours on a time when they get a little bit older, because they recognize it's hurting themselves.
But isn't it easier? It's easier for parents just to park. It's like it used to be in front of the TV, you know. But I watched a lot of TV growing up in the 70s. But number one, it was great TV. It was just great television. 70s were like the golden era of TV. It was great TV, like Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, that's where I got my sense of humor, right? Is watching 70s
MASH
television. Yeah, right. all the great old shows.
Right.
So, but I don't know. It's a different thing when you need that. You have to hit the button and it takes you somewhere else. And I think it was Dr. Barbara Jennings, who's a cognitive scientist, gave this TED Talk we were watching, and I just want to play this and get your reaction.
It turns out that everything about this technology is designed to rope us in, from the alert that it emits to the amount of text you can see on the screen. And we buy into it because we've become information seekers. Even the text on a news media, audios, visuals, and text scrolling across the screen, and we go for it. The most common use of cell phones is occurring in college students. They're receiving about 100 texts a day and checking for their texts an additional 60 times a day. Their compulsive addiction isn't to the cell phone. It's to the dopamine they get every time they get a message.
The chemical part of all of this.
Yes.
Dr. Stroman, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I think that if you look at, and I did a TED Talk as well and talked about the dopamine as well as the structural, the dopamine itself, what Dr. Jennings is talking about, is so key. Because what we used to think was that the anticipation wasn't what was cueing us. It was actually reading the text message. But now we know that dopamine receptor is actually just anticipating. So now you strap on a wearable on your wrist or you have a cell phone that buzzes, right? It's the anticipation. It's the part that we don't know what we're going to get on the other end that causes that spike and that increase in dopamine. So she's absolutely right. Her numbers are a little behind in terms of how many times we check text messages with adults, college students themselves. I think that the rate now is about 30% of them do all of their academic work on a cell phone. They're just absolutely never without it. So those numbers are so high at this point.
Oh, my God. That is, I don't even know what to say about that. It's going to have a sociological, long-term sociological, physical, and psychological, cultural effect on our, you know, on our country, on our world. I mean, the world will never be the same again, and there's a lot of conveniences. We all know that, and a lot of good stuff. But the biggest seller online is porn, is it not? Isn't that the biggest seller by far?
Yeah. I have one daughter and one son, and I think that we will lose a generation of young men. We've already lost. I think that the Me Too movement isn't even touching our children because of the proliferation of porn. Average age is 8 at first viewing, and now chronic viewing is 11. So we've got these young children in elementary school starting to be infused with this porn industry so early on, when they literally are trying to develop their sense of self, their sense of sexuality. And so now I see college students and young adults that have what I would call pedophilic tendencies, because they originally created this sexual attachment at a very early age, and nobody's talking about that. It's terrifying.
Oh my God. I mean, the young boys, the average age you see your first pornographic image is what, 9 years old? Is that correct still?
Right, 8 or 9, yes.
And then it's so easy, especially for boys, to become addicted to those images. And then what does that do to their sexual performance as years go on? What does that do?
Well, we see a lot in the cases when I go into high schools or middle schools even, and I talk to these kids, a lot of the girls are either getting distributed child pornography because boys are taking pictures of themselves and sending them, or when they get girls alone, they initially think that the best thing that they can do is pull out their private and have the girl, you know, want to touch it. And so I spend a lot of my time telling boys, I'm like, hey, there's not a woman alive that I've ever met in my life that wakes up in the morning and says, please, I can't wait if I get a picture today of somebody's penis, but I'm going to be so excited. This is not going to happen. So I try to combat this kind of porn infusion in their brains with some reality day in and day out when I'm talking about these things with the kids.
Well, I think that we'll have a really upsetting conversation with our, you know, with ourselves, with our communities, with our families, and then we'll think it's too late. You know, like why didn't we do something earlier? And when we found out, Dr. Stroman, that the tech CEOs, most of them don't even give their children the access to devices that the regular person does. They knew from the very beginning what these were going to be. Maybe not every aspect, but I mean, we already found that out. Was it, I don't know if it was Bill Gates, or they understood that these were going to be very, very addictive devices.
So I will tell you that when I did the TED Talk in Pasadena, I had Bill Gates, I had Steve Jobs, and I had Michael Dell, and I had the stats of how they restricted their family's access, and the TED family asked me to take it out. They said, we can't put that in your talk. And to me, it's so
what?
Infuriating.
Wait. Explain that to our podcast listeners one more time. So you're giving a TED Talk, which is seen all over the world.
I'm giving a TED Talk all over the world, and they said, you have to submit. This is what our talk is about. Mine is empowering children to rise above technology addiction. So for me, it's all about, you know, my background, how do I get them to understand this is a real issue. And let me tell you, and I talk about that the tech industry is exactly using the same playbook as the tobacco industry. So they are doing hook, line, and sinker, the exact same thing that was happening. And I bring up in my script This is what Bill Gates doesn't allow any of his children to have any technology before the age of 14. Steve Jobs didn't allow any of his kids to have any Apple products or tablets in their house. And Michael Dell spent like $1.8 million on security and programming in the house to ensure that his kids wouldn't go into areas that they shouldn't do. It'd be nice if we could afford that as listeners, right, to protect our kids the same way. They said, we can't have that in there. We're not going to name people in the industry in a talk like this, and had me scrub that part of my talk.
Well, when big companies or big organizations end up censoring voices that give important pieces of information, what does that become? I mean, some of these big organizations and big companies are like mini governments. We have to understand that because they have so much power. So if you are an individual who said, no, you can't say this, then where is the freedom of expression? Where is the freedom of speech? Once your TED talk is altered, that's
right.
Disturbing. They are proving your point, are they not? In all of this.
They absolutely are. Yeah. And it's frustrating to try to get back into the mainstream. Yeah, to talk about the privacy and how, you know, under the veil of what the consumers are interested in, for instance, the Apple industry has taken off 9 out of the 11 parent monitoring apps off of their system, saying that they violate the privacy of the children that are involved, right? So the public thinks, okay, you know, what is Apple doing? In my opinion, we're competing against what they're doing, and they're taking off our ability as parents and as consumers to be able to protect and monitor and make sure that what we're doing. But nobody wants to talk about that part, right? Nobody wants to see the realities of why, under the veil of privacy, that they say that they're doing that.
Well, I know it's hard for parents, or you think it's hard, but you can do it. I mean, there have been some times in my house where, you know, I had this iPads for, you know, answering the door. Well, you know, I shut that down real quick when I found that, you know, again, a kid picks it up, they put in one word in a search engine, and then all of a sudden you find out they're getting that thing in the middle of the night and looking at things they shouldn't be looking at. That had to happen one time for me, and that was it. Every iPad's out of my house. I don't have any iPad. It's all gone. Everything's locked down. I have to use a computer, but it has like 3 passwords on it. It's restricted. You can't even go on YouTube if you wanted to. So all of this is, but I had to learn the hard way, and it was a scary, scary moment. But you just have to bite the bullet and do it as a parent. There's no other way. There is no other way. Might as well just give your kid over to a internet predator, because that's essentially what you're doing. Even if they're just preying on your child's mind.
Well, and I think that you're absolutely right. And I think it is hard. I empathize with it. I think as a parent, it's not our job to be their friend. It's our job to keep them healthy, happy, and safe, right? And if a child is looking at disturbing pornographic images or death images or whatever it is that's taking them down this road, you're going to have a psychologically traumatized child. So I think people don't talk about the secondary and tertiary causes of internet imaging that they see, because you can't unsee those things. Mm-hmm. And these are good kids with good families that are seeing terrible things. And then the parents feel very, embarrassed or ashamed oftentimes that this has happened to them. And I'm here to tell you, it happens to all of us. And so how do we create, you know, this is my passion of how do we create kids to be part of the solution so they understand it, and parents get them support in figuring out how do we understand that there are so many things that we can't teach them about predators at the level they need to be taught. But if you create, you know, an app that all the kids go to, it would be the same as saying, you know what, I'm going to go to Disneyland, where I know a lot of predators know that there's young kids going around with parents that are exhausted. There's going to be a higher rate of predators there. The online apps are the same thing. You build an app like Minecraft or Roblox for the little kids, you're going to get predators that hack in there and start to have conversations, which we call grooming and luring when we do that. So as parents, don't love your kids so much that you assume that because they're good kids, they're not going to step into potholes or mud holes of technology areas of malice, because they're out there, and these guys are out there looking for our kids every day. And it's, to me, when I worked at the FBI as a visiting scholar, I did homicidal pedophilia. Those guys could go after five kids in a 30-day period. Today, I can have a predator that's going after 250 to 300 kids in a 30-day period without a geographical, like, restriction on them. And the kids go to them. They don't even have to drive in the white van and try to go around and pick up your kids. They just go to the most popular apps and start having conversations.
I hate all of this.
I hate grooming.
The word grooming. First of all, the penalties for doing anything to a child, an elderly person, an animal, anyone who's, I think that the penalties should just be, I'm sorry, the worst penalties ever, criminal penalties. But you can't, you have to, we have to be honest about what the world is now. And we're not trying to be alarmist. I mean, Dr. Stroman, I know a lot of people are listening and said, oh, you're exaggerating the threat or you think, until it's happened to you. And believe me, as someone who's seen these disturbing images just pop up on a screen because someone hit some app or something, I'm like, what? Like, how did this possibly? And it chills you to the bone, and it makes you hurt as a parent. But it doesn't. You don't have to live that way. There are just these common sense, ways to, to safeguard against this. And so I'll have you close it out for us. This is such an important conversation, Dr. Stroman. Your final thoughts.
I would say that, as parents, like, you need to limit, you need to monitor, you need to understand what your kids are doing online. And so a particular point for your listeners in the end is, a lot of people think Snapchat, one of the most popular apps, is harmless if we're monitoring it. But Snapchat itself has a mapping technique from it. So I've had three families contact me through Digital Citizen Academy that have told me themselves that their child was targeted, a stranger came to their door, and in two of those cases, that child was sexually assaulted. We're talking in one of them was a gated community, and two of them were in affluent neighborhoods. This is not for parents to pretend like it's not happening. Engage with your kids, understand their passwords, and do not let them go on apps that you know that a predator or somebody out there that would be interested in your child would be able to access them. Please, like, that's all I do is try to keep our families and our kids safe.
Dr. Lisa Stroman is the founder of the Digital Citizen Academy. It's a terrific online curriculum. Please check it out. Is it digitalcitizenacademy.com? What's the website?
.org.
And thank you so much. We'll link this all up, Dr. Stroman, on our website and our Facebook page. So many parents are listening to this podcast across the country, across the globe. The citizens of this country, be alert. It's digitalcitizenacademy.org. Lisa Stroman, thank you so much. And let's go to Curtis in Maryland, who has his own approach to all of this. Curtis, welcome.
Hey, thank you, Laura, for taking my call.
I
listened to you for years, appreciated you on terrestrial radio, and now I get very excited when I see your latest podcast that's posted on my phone.
Appreciate it.
We have raised three adult children, and they were right on the edge of the internet age. And now we are blessed with being able to raise our granddaughter. We've had her for 10 years, and she's 10 years old. And we're homeschooling her. I did teach high school for about 6 years, so that told me homeschooling was the way to go. But we involve her in the community. We throw her outside with a pogo stick, and the other kids that sit underneath the trees with their devices just look at her and scratch their head, and they actually think it's pretty cool that she has a pogo stick and a little homemade go-kart. Recently had an experience where we sent her off to Girl Scout camp. We took great care in packing her bag, and I got her a set of walkie-talkies like we all might have played with as kids. And we practiced with them, and she thought she was going to be the coolest kid at camp with these walkie-talkies. As the bus pulled up, we were loading her bags, she saw her friends, and she said, "Hey, guys, I have walkie-talkies." My heart fell to the ground when these other 10-year-old girls, two of them, turned around with cell phones and says, "Who needs those? We have cell phones." It just broke her heart. I mean, she's exposed to the real world. She uses electronics for her homeschooling, for items of her curriculum, but it's still very closely monitored by us.
Yeah, it's the only way to go. How do you like the homeschooling?
Oh, I just love it. I wish first thing I did was apologize to my adult children for sending them
because lousy schools.
I talked to my adult children when I was teaching high school, and I said, was this happening when you? And they said, yeah, Dad, we were just afraid to tell you because you'd get mad.
Oh, no. Well, she's lucky to have you. I mean, it's a lot of people can't do it. I mean, can I say something? Curtis, I would be the worst homeschooling mom teacher ever. You know what I'd be good at is, like, teaching the sports. I'm good at that. But I would be terrible. This would be my approach. How do you not understand this? Come on, we've gone over it four times. And meanwhile, in math and you know, the really hard math stuff, as it got up, you know, real up algebra 2 stuff, I had to get so much help. But I would have no patience for teaching it. I'd be terrible.
Oh, yeah. That, my parents were considering it, too. But my mom is just like you.
Oh, no.
No patience. Sorry,
no patience.
Mom. Love you. But.
You know, some people are just really good teachers. That's why I still remember. I think I think about my high school teachers who were amazing. They were public school teachers. But Curtis, this was in the late 1970s, 80s. They were great teachers. I had a lot of male teachers who were fabulous. I mean, just incredible teachers. Glastonbury High School, Glastonbury, Connecticut. Awesome, awesome teachers. But the world has changed now. Now they're doing gender bending and all this politics in the classroom. And it's a horror show for a lot of parents. Not every school, but too many schools. And I just think a lot of parents don't want to subject their kids to that. Curtis, thanks so much. We really appreciate it. I want to thank all of our sponsors. Really interesting podcast today. Cerovital, Delta Animal Rescue, and Sheiks. They supported the show, among others. All great people, great products, great services. And remember, America now and forever. The Laura Ingraham Podcast, always here for you. See you next time.
What is your emergency?
A brutal murder that took place in Washington, D.C.
To do what he did to four people, including a 10-year-old boy, is just beyond words.
A family and their housekeeper held hostage and tortured for 19 hours before their mansion was set on fire with them inside.
It's just hard to imagine that such a nice family could be the victim of something so depraved.
In WTOP's 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, you'll be shocked by the new details of this heinous crime, and you won't believe how investigators brought the killer to justice.
He did not act alone. Mark my words.
Download 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, with new episodes every Monday on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.